Think we can get started. It's 8 p.m. Erev Tov, everybody. And we have a double Haftorah this week. Let's see which one we're going to choose. Matzah or Maaseh, right? Okay, Vakasha.
Okay. What happened to it? Here it is. Okay. So as you can see from the title that I gave it, the Haftarah this week is week two of catastrophe. We spoke last week, gave a bit of an introduction to the special Haftarot of the 3 weeks, the three Shabbatot between Shivasar B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, which we did the first one last week, and that's really the prologue or the lead-in to this week's Haftarah. Last week it was the first chapter of the book of Yirmiyahu, and this picks up in the second chapter of that same book. The Haftarah for next week, however, reverts back to the book of Yeshayahu, where we will speak about the Haftarah that comes from the very first chapter of the book by that name. And that actually will usher in a period of a considerable period of time where we will be pretty much limiting ourselves to Haftarot from the book of Yeshayahu. So this week we'll move on, as I said, to the second chapter of Yirmiyahu. And I want you to join me here in this exercise apropos of the first segment of the Haftarah, the one that essentially rebukes, chastises the people of Israel for their lack of gratitude to God for all of the good and wonderful things that he did for them. And I just want you to take a look. You know that I assume that you've gotten accustomed to the quirks of my color coding. So generally, things that are green are good. Things that are red are bad. So I want you to join me in this small segment of the Haftarah and to see just what the balance is here between the good and the bad. You may recall from last week's Haftarah that Yirmiyahu's prophetic mission was described in both positive and negative terms, both benevolent and malevolent. Numerically speaking, statistically speaking, the malevolent outnumbers the benevolent. It was, if you recall, lintosh v'lintotz, lahavid u'laharos, to uproot, to tear down, to destroy, to eliminate, but then also livnot v'lintoa, to rebuild and to replant. So indeed, our expectations of Yirmiyahu are such that there will be some sort of an oscillation, if you wish, between the good and the bad. So what we have here, the things that are described, the things that are colored in green, are the things that God did for the Jewish people. And those are the positive things in this segment of the Haftarah, while the ones that are colored in red are the things that the Jewish people did in response to God. And they're colored red to highlight the fact that they are the negative side of this segment of the Haftarah. So, for example, starting in the very top, the fourth line from the top, God says through Yirmiyahu to the Jewish people, basically, "Mamatzu avotechem bi'avel ki rachaku me'alai." What is it that I ever did in the sense of doing something bad to your ancestors, that they distanced themselves from me, that they alienated themselves from me, vayelochu acharei hahevel, so that they left me, and instead they followed something called hevel, and as a result of that, vayehebalu, they themselves became hevel. You may remember hevel is the name of one of the first children born in the world, but this hevel is somewhat different. This hevel is more like the constant hevel in the book of Ecclesiastes, in the book of Kohelet. The famous line, Havel Havalim Amar Kohelet, Havel Havalim HaKol Havel. You get a fivefold repetition of the word hevel in a single biblical verse. That's usually translated as vanity of vanities, right? All is vain. The word hevel literally means steam. Right? The steam that comes up from a pot that's cooking, from a kettle that's boiling, is hevel. And it's a metaphor for vanity, because that's what vanity is. Vanity is something that gives the appearance of substance, but there's really nothing there. Same it is with steam. I mean, you can see steam. Steam will fog up a mirror or fog up a glass, right? But in essence, it just evaporates. There's really nothing there. So what God accuses the Jewish people of is abandoning him and in his stead, following after something that looked good, but was really empty of substance, as a result of which they themselves became hevel, they themselves became lacked substance. Okay, so that's the first instance of something that the Jewish people did in response to God's goodness to them. The goodness is what appears in the next verse, v'lo amaru, that they should have known better, because they should have been able to say in the sense not just of articulation, but in the sense of just intellectual recognition, ayeh Hashem hama'ale otanu me'eretz Mitzrayim. Right? They know of God as the one who took them out of the land of Egypt, hamolich otanu bamidbar, who led them through the wilderness, be'eretz arava v'shulchan, land that was arid and a land of pits, be'eretz tziyah v'tzal mavet, again, arid and lands of dry land, be'eretz lavar ba'ish, a land, the wilderness that ordinarily is not crossed by people. V'lo yashav adam sham, and it's generally a place that is uninhabited. And there's another goodness that God did for them. Va'avi etchem, God brought them el eretz ha-karmel. We'll talk about that in a couple of moments. To a land that is agriculturally blessed, le'echol piryah v'tuvah, in order to be able to enjoy what grows in that land. And yet, in response to all of these good things that God did for them, what was the people's response? Vatavo'u vatetam'u et artzi, that they came and they rendered the land impure. V'nachalati samtem le'to'aivah, and they transformed God's country into an abomination. Okay? And there's one more element at the end of the next verse, v'acharei lo yo'ilu halachu. That's pretty much the same as the end of verse 5. There it says, v'yelchu acharei ha-hevel, and here it says, v'acharei lo yo'ilu halachu. Lo yo'ilu is something that is futile. So in essence, vanity and futility are a pair. So in essence, the substance of these opening remarks is a condemnation of the Jewish people for their failure to express gratitude to God. The gratitude isn't that they should go around saying, oh God, thank you, thank you, thank you. The minimum that's involved in gratitude, at least, is to recognize the source of goodness by not turning your back on it, by not abandoning it. So because the Jewish people abandoned God, and obviously we know that what they did in their substitution for God was they worshiped idols, okay, then what it is the most abominable act of ingratitude that they could have demonstrated. So, as I said, we get kind of a balance here if we just simply try to look at the positive as opposed to the negative. Okay. Now, you notice that there are also some words that are underlined, and that there are two forms of underlining. There's a solid underlining, and then there's kind of like a squiggly underlining. And this, too, has a reason. So let's take a look and see. What do the four words that are underlined in verse 5 have in common? Matzu, rachaku, yelachu, yehebalu. What do they all have in common? They are all third person masculine verbs in the perfect. Perfect is what we call the past tense, okay? But they're the third person of the verb. Matzu, they found. Rachaku, they distanced. Vayelachu, they went. Vayehabalu, they were vain or futile, okay? Now, if you look, however, in verse 7, you see the words that are, the verbs that are underlined, or the words that are underlined in the squiggly underlines, etachem, right? That's second person, masculine, plural, okay? Tavo, that's also second person, masculine, plural. Samtem, second person, masculine, plural, okay? And then again in verse 8, it reverts back to the third person. Amru, they said. Pasha'u, they sinned. Nibu, they prophesied. Halachu, they went. So at first glance, this looks kind of odd, right? I mean, Yirmiyahu didn't change. His audience didn't change, right? Yirmiyahu is one person who's addressing a collective audience. And if the audience is standing right in front of him, okay, then he should be speaking and addressing them in the second person. He should be saying, you. Okay. Now, of course, in verse 5, the reason that the verbs are in the third person is because he's talking about avotechem. He's talking about, right, ancestors. The ancestors aren't there. Therefore, the people to whom he's talking, right, he addresses in the second person. But when he talks about their ancestors, he's talking about people who are not present, and therefore he speaks of them in the third person. That's what it seems to be. But there's nothing different in verse 7, because the people whom God brought into the land of Israel in order to eat its fruits and enjoy its goodness were, again, their ancestors. So it doesn't matter whether he's talking to the immediate audience or whether he's talking about an audience that's in the distant past. He should be talking to that audience in the same person. They should either all be in the third person or they should all be in the second person. And then when it comes to verse 8, it gets even more complicated, because when he talks about certain Kohanim, who no longer say Ayei Hashem, who don't seek a God, and he talks about certain people called Tofsei HaTorah, those who, you see the English translation, who handle the Torah, right? Who no longer know God, and the Ro'im, the shepherds, who turned against God, who transgressed against him, and the prophets, who rather than prophesying in the name of God, prophesied in the name of the Baal, right? He's talking about his immediate audience. And yet, he persists, as it were, in addressing them in the third person. So the question is, how do we account for this vacillation between the third person to the second person to the third person? And I suspect that what it is just simply a useful rhetorical device. That is to say, it's something that good public speakers use. Good public speakers, especially if they are critical of their audiences, might use as a tactic speaking to the audience as though they were speaking about somebody else. A preacher, for example, might get up and say to the audience, what would you say about somebody who does X, Y, and Z? Now, his purpose, of course, eventually is to say to the people, you are the X, Y, and Z. But if he starts out by saying, you're sinners, right? You're traitors to God, right? You are abominable, right? He might lose his audience. This way, when he starts off by saying, once upon a time, right? So the people might get into it and say, oh, he's not talking about me. He's talking about somebody else. So if he says, once upon a time, there were people who show their ingratitude to God, likely as not, the audience might say, that's terrible. People should be grateful to God. Well, I would be grateful to God if I had the opportunity, right? And then, as it were, he lowers the rhetorical boom, so to speak, and he says, I started off by talking about your ancestors, right? But in reality, I'm talking about you. So that may very well explain this shifting between the second and third persons, because indeed, rhetorically, he was addressing different audiences. Okay. Here, just to give you an idea, are some of the same words, some of the same descriptive terms that were used by the prophet Yirmiyahu in describing the people's ingratitude towards God. You see them here, particularly in verse 7, Vatavou vatetama'u et arutsi, that you rendered my land impure, you defiled it, v'nachalati, and my heritage, samtem l'toeva, you turned it into an abomination. So the idea that land can be defiled, that land can be rendered into an abomination, right, is something that we see here in the tail end of the Sidra v'Acharei Mot, and actually it is the Torah reading for the afternoon, for Mincha of Yom HaKippurim, in which the prohibited relationships, the incestuous and adulterous relationships that are prohibited by the Torah, are described in terms of defilement and abomination. And you can simply see just how these terms proliferate. In 6 or 7 brief verses, there are pretty much nearly a dozen different uses of the term letame, to defile, and toeva, abomination. And notice, while it starts off by saying to the people, al titame'u b'chol eile, do not defile yourselves through these practices, it goes on in the next verse to say, vatitmaha aretz. Not only can people defile themselves, not only can people become impure, but the land itself can become impure. And it says in verse 27, ki et kol hatoevot, I neglected to highlight this, ki et kol hatoevot ha'el asu anshei ha'aretz asher lifneichem, that these abominations, right, the practice of these incestuous and adulterous relationships were practiced by the inhabitants of the land of Canaan, the people who inhabited the land before the Jewish people conquered it, vatitma ha'aretz, and they caused the land to become impure and defiled. And what did the land do when it became impure? It vomited them out. V'lotaki ha'aretz etchem, lest the earth vomit you out, v'tama'achem ota, if you were to defile it, kasher ka'a, as it in fact did, et ha'goy asher lufnechem, to the people, to the Canaanite people who inhabited it previously. So we see that when the prophet Yirmiyahu says to the people, you defiled the land, we're assuming that the people then were able in their mind's eye to recall the warnings of the Torah against this kind of defilement, and were able therefore to understand and to acknowledge the extent of their ingratitude. Same thing here at the end of this week's Torah reading, the very end of the Sidra of Mas'ei, where the judges of Israelite courts are warned, v'lo tikhu kofer lanus el ir miklato, not to allow murderers or at least people who have killed somebody else, and it is yet to be determined whether these were deliberate acts of murder or not, you should not accept from them ransom to enable them to go to an Ir Miklat, to a city of refuge. Why? V'lo tachanifu et ha'aretz asher atem ba. Because this too would be a form of defilement of the land. Ki hadam hu yachanif et ha'aretz. Because the earth, as it were, itself becomes defiled when innocent blood is spilled upon it. V'la'aretz lo yechupar ladam asher shupach ba. And the only way, as it were, to atone for the blood that was spilled on the earth is bidam shofecho, through the execution of the murderer. V'lo titamei et ha'aretz. Once again, that idea that the earth itself, the land itself, could be rendered impure and defiled. So again, we see that this is a constant theme throughout the Torah, and it is reiterated here, echoed here, in the vision of Yirmiyahu. As for the reference in verse 7 to the land of Israel as a land of Carmel, so first of all, I should point out that the land of Carmel is not only the forest area in the vicinity of the port city of Haifa, and it isn't limited to the mountain on which the city of Haifa is situated, which is called Mount Carmel, nor even to that mountain range in that vicinity that is called Har HaKarmel or Harre HaKarmel, the Carmel mountain range. There is actually a site in Israel. It's actually in the Judean desert. In the Judean desert, south of Hebron, it was inhabited during the biblical period. It is no longer, but it was called Carmel. You may remember that King David, right? One of King David's wives was the wife of Nabal ha-Carmeli, right? She was originally married to a rich landowner in Carmel, and then after he died, right, David took her as one of his wives, okay? That was also called Carmel, because literally the word Carmel is a grain. Carmel is a designation of grain, okay? So in Eretz HaCarmel is a land that produces grain. You see the English translation here is a land of fruitful fields. This is to say, a land that is agriculturally productive, okay? And indeed, you see in the commentary of Radak that I have cited here, he asks the question, Masha Samacho Tal HaKarmel, why is the land of Israel here compared to rich farmland? Lefi Sheha'aretz HaNe'evedet, because land that is cultivated, Bisadot, in fields, the kramim, vineyards, the ilanot, tovim, and orchards, nikra Carmel, right? It's a collective term that can be used to designate any agriculturally fertile land. Ulefisha Eretz Yisrael haitakein, and because this designation suited the land of Israel, obviously not everything in the land of Israel, but it's suitable for a large portion of the land of Israel. Okay, that's why it received this designation. Kemoshe katuv aleha, as indeed it is said of the land of Israel, that it is a land of chita u'seora, v'gefen u'teina v'rimon, eretz zeit shemen u'dvash, the seven species for which the land of Israel was singularly blessed. Okay, so this is the opening of the Haftarah, where the prophet Yirmiyahu rebukes the Jewish people for their ingratitude towards God. Now, he also, we saw the terms that are highlighted here in purple, okay? He spoke specifically about clearly what seemed to be the leadership of the Jewish people. If anybody should have been expected to lead the people in the right path and to make sure that they were properly grateful to God, it should have been their leaders. So it mentions religious leaders who are called either Kohanim or Tovsei HaTorah, the ones who hold on to the Torah. It talks about Ro'im, shepherds, which might very well be their political leadership, okay? And Nevi'im, that's the spiritual leadership. And indeed, these terms, these offices, are the ones that the prophets regularly refer to when they are addressing the people. The prophet Micha, for example, again, being critical of the leadership of the Jewish people, spoke about Rasheha, that again would seem to be political leadership, Kohaneha, religious leadership, Nevi'eha, spiritual leadership. The prophet Malachi, in a haftarah that we looked at ourselves much earlier in the year, spoke about Siftei Kohen Yishmeru Da'at, right? That the lips or the speech of the Kohen preserves knowledge. V'Torah Yevakshu Mipihu. And he is the source of Torah instruction to people, kind of like the Tovsei HaTorah here, okay? The prophet Yechezkel mentioned the fact that the people, uvikshu chazon minavi, if the people want vision, who can inform them of a vision? That would be the Navi, the prophet. Torah, if they're seeking Torah instruction, they go to the Kohen. And if they want Eitzah, which would be good advice in general, then they go to the Zekenim, to the elders. And there's even a proverb that was coined in the book of Mishlei, in the book of Proverbs, Be'en Chazon, in the absence of vision, Yipara'am, people go to pieces, right? Bishomer Torah, however, even in a dire situation, someone who can preserve the Torah, Ashrehu, will be well off. So here we have again Shomrei Torah, very similar to the term used by Yirmiyahu, Tofisei HaTorah. And I found that there was an interesting split amongst the commentators as to whether Tofisei Torah was good or bad. The Aramaic Targum rendered Tofisei Torah in Aramaic as Malfei Oraita. Malfei, if it were written with an aleph, me'alefei would look a little more familiar because we recognize the shoresh aleph lamed pei, like in the word ulpan, as being related to instruction. So malfei oraita are Torah teachers. Rashi specifies which Torah teachers in particular: the Sanhedrin, members of the Supreme Court. Radak, a little more generic, says Hachachamim lomidei haTorah, scholars who study Torah. Shadal, Shmuel David Luzzatto, said, Anshei haHorah, educators, religious educators. Okay, but we go back to the verse for a second. Are these leadership positions here being are they being spoken of positively or negatively? It's negative, right? Kohanim lo amru, Tofsei HaTorah lo yedauni, okay? Therefore, Malbim, in his commentary, says, HaTfisa, when it describes these people as holding on to the Torah, he says, Tfisa, hi ha'achiza b'chaf. It's when you take something in a fist. Uba al ba'alei haTorah, and its application here to the Torah, he says, is b'derech genai. It's a slur. It's not being said of them in the positive sense, but in the negative sense. And he gives other examples like tofes cherev, right? Somebody who holds a sword, right? Tofes keshet, an archer. Tofes Magal, somebody who holds a scythe. Tofes kinor v'ugav, somebody who holds a harp or a lyre. Meaning, when you describe somebody as being a tofes of an object, you're describing it as a profession. Ritzono lomar shehatorah lahem keomanut. They treat the Torah as it were, as though it were a profession. Ukikardom, and as though it were an axe, lachtoch ba, to use. And remember the Rabbi Kalman, of course, in Friday morning class on Pirkei Avot, the Mishnah in Avot says that one should not make the Torah a kardom lachpor ba. One should not transform Torah or Torah study into a medium and an instrument for acquiring wealth. So Malbim says that the use of Tofsei HaTorah in this case is clearly negative, because it speaks of people who, rather than honoring and respecting the Torah as the word of God, see their study or even their teaching of Torah as just simply a way to earn money. Okay. The second part of the Haftarah, notice again the distribution of red and green. Okay, red are the green are the positive elements, references to God as a makor mayim chayim, a fountain, a source of living waters. And the red again are the people's ingratitude to God. They exchange hahemir goy Elohim, it says in verse 11, v'heima lo Elohim. Where else on earth have people swapped their gods for something that is not divine? Va'ami, whereas the Jewish people, hemir kevodo belo yo'il, has swapped or exchanged its glory, again, for something that is worthless, something that is futile. The question about whether kavodo here refers back to the Jewish people, or whether what it really is a euphemism, and what the prophet really meant, speaking in God's name, is that the people hemir kavodi belo yoil, that they swapped God for an idol that is futile. Okay, and therefore he says in verse 12. Shomu shamayim al zot. This behavior is so uncommon, this behavior is so egregious, that the heavens themselves are just simply shocked at it. V'sa'aru charevu ma'od. And the heavens are exhibiting amazement at this behavior. Kishtayim ra'ot asa ami, because the Jewish people managed in one single act to commit two transgressions against God. One is oti azavu, they abandoned God, and that itself was ra, was wicked, because God is a makor mayim chayim, is the source of living waters. And what did they do? They not only left God. Okay, so they're not going to keep Shabbos anymore. They're not going to keep Kashrut anymore. But they went beyond that. Not only did they just simply leave God and the Torah, but they left it lachtsov lahem borot, that in search of something to replace the font of living waters, they went as though to dig new wells. But the wells that they dug were borot nishbarim. They were wells that were broken, asher lo yachilu hamayim, which could not keep, they could not hold the water that was poured into them. So in that single act, they not only abandoned God, but they turned away from God towards something that offered them really no use or purpose. Now, he started here by saying that their behavior is so strange that if we went as far as Iye Kitiyim, the islands of the Kittim. Or if we went to a place towards called Kedar, okay, and we asked about, we asked the inhabitants of those places, Hein Haita Kazo, have you ever experienced, have you ever witnessed such a thing? That is to say, that a people will abandon its God and exchange it for something useless. So the question, of course, is, I assume that to Jeremiah's audience, they knew where the Kittim Isles were, and they knew where the land of Kedar was. You notice that the translation here just simply transliterates it. It does not attempt to identify it. Okay? The Talmud probably knew it as well, but there's a statement in the Talmud citing our verse that says, why were the Kittim and the Kedariim chosen by the prophet? Because Kutiim ovdim la'esh, the people who lived in the isles of the Kittim worshipped fire. The Kedariim, the people in the land of Kedar, ovdim la'mayim, they worshipped water. I should add parenthetically that at least in the Middle Ages, Kedar was identified with Arabia. And it would certainly make sense to say that people who live in a desert, right, hold water in great respect. So it certainly fits if indeed that identification is correct. Okay, but the point here is as follows. Af al pi sheyodeim, even though both the Kutiim and the Kadariim know, shehamayim mechabin et ha'esh, that water extinguishes fire, lo hemiru elohehem. Meaning, you would have expected the Kittim who worship fire, that once somebody from Kedar came along and poured cold water on their god and extinguished it, that they would cease to worship that god. They would say, this is not a real god, it was extinguished. Nevertheless, says the Talmud, in spite of the fact that it is demonstrable that water extinguishes fire, these people were true to their gods and they did not exchange them. And what about the Jewish people? Va'ami hemir kvodo belo yo'il. The Jewish people did the opposite. They abandoned God, who is the source of good and of purpose, and they exchanged it for something that is useless and futile. And this reminded me of a verse in chapter 106 in the book of Psalms, which is a poetic recap of early Jewish history, in which the Chet HaEgel, the sin that was committed shortly after Matan Torah with the building and the worshiping of the golden calf, is described as vayamiru et kivodam, they exchanged their glory. And again, as I said, this could be a euphemism. It should maybe understood as vayamiru et kvodi, they exchanged the glory of God, bitavnit shor ochel esev, as though they exchanged something of great value for something of lesser value. And that, of course, is the whole point here of the prophet. If people change things, they usually change them for what they could see as being an improvement. Therefore, go all about the world, says the prophet. Where do you find people like the Israelites who, rather than exchanging something inferior for something superior, have exchanged something that is clearly superior for something that is inferior to it? And what will be their punishment? He describes it as follows. He asks a series of rhetorical questions. Ha'eved Yisrael? Is the Jewish people a servant? Im yilid bayatu? Is he a servant who is born to his master rather than purchased? Madua haya lavaz? Why has he now become prey, right, to the nations? Alav yishagu kfirim the other nations, the enemies of Israel, will surround it like young lions, natnu kolam, and roar in anticipation of seizing their prey. Vayashitu arzo l'shamayim, indeed they will seize his land and turn it desolate. Arav nitzitu, and they will burn down his cities, or they will lay them waste, mibli yoshev, and they will exile all of its inhabitants. And again, harking to distant places, gam b'nei nof v'tach pan ches yiruch kod kod. Even the inhabitants of Nov and Tachpanches, which are places in Egypt, Yiruch Kod Kod, they will, as it were, strike you on the head. Halozot ta'aselach, and what is the cause of all of this? Ozvechet Hashem Elohayich, you're having abandoned God, Be'et Molichech Badarech, God who led you again out of Egypt through the wilderness into the land of Israel. Va'ata, and now, malach l'derech Mitzrayim. Why do you constantly turn, as it were, as though you long to return to Egypt? Lishtot me shichor. Do you need to drink the waters of Shichor, which one assumes in the context of Egypt is a reference to the Nile? Malach l'derech Ashur. Why do you keep turning to Mesopotamia? Lishtot me nahar, as it were, to drink the waters of the river. The river here is specifically the river with a capital R, the Euphrates. Tiasrech ra'atech, your own wickedness will strike you. Mishuvotayech tochichuch, your own recidivism will chastise you, will rebuke you. Udi'i uri'i, you will see and you will come to know. Ki rav amar ozvechet Hashem Elohayech, that your abandonment of God is evil. Right? V'lo pachdati elayech nu'um Hashem Elokim tzeva'ot, and they have lost and cast about their fear of God. The terms yilid bayit, nikne kesef, eved, are recognizable from other parts of the Torah as designations of different categories of slaves. As I said, there's a slave who might be purchased. Yilid bayit is a slave who was born into slavery. But this idea in the last verse, that the Jewish people's own wickedness and their own backsliding will be the cause of their own punishment, is explained here by Radak. He says, after you have experienced on several occasions, kiva asotech ra'a, that if you do something bad, yavolach ra, you will suffer as a consequence. Uba'avur meshuvotayech, and on account of your repeated offenses, sha'at moredet bi, in your rebellion against God, yimshuluvacha oyavim heim ba'atzman, you will be overtaken by your enemies. Therefore, the consequence is, the result is, ra'atech, your evil, meshuvotayech, your repeated offenses, yulach musar betochecha liyasrech, they in and of themselves will serve to chastise you, shelo tashuvi og bederech ha-ra'ah, to prevent you from once again going upon this evil path. Why? Shaharei nisit, because you have felt, you've experienced it yourself, ki avolach ra'ah ba'avura, that you will suffer on account of it. And that, he says, is the meaning of di'i uri'i ki ramar ozvechet Hashem Elokayach, the conclusion of that segment. He then moves on and describes idolatry in terms that we've seen already in the prophet Hosea in particular. You remember the prophecy in which God instructs Hosea to go out, as it were, and to take as a wife a woman of harlotry, right? To marry an Eshet Zinunim. And again, this, of course, is the simile that the prophet Hosea and other prophets use for idolatry. Idolatry is like adultery. The Jewish people symbolically are married to God, and therefore their abandonment of God, and their taking up, as it were, with another deity, with an idol, is a form of adultery. So here, God, again, hearkens, the prophet hearkens back to the past and says, Kime olam, right? From days of yore, shavarti ulech, nitakti mosorotayech. If you were enslaved, I broke the yoke that you bore. If you were bound up, tied up, nitakti mosrotayech, I severed the bonds that tied you up. Vatomri, and you said, lo e'evor, right? I'm not going to do anything wrong. Kial kol giv'ah givoha, and yet, on every hilltop, v'tachat kol eitz ra'anan, remember we also had these in previous haftarot, those were the places where idols were worshipped. Hilltops because it was symbolically closer to heaven, right? And beneath trees, particularly Asherah trees, because they symbolized growth and fruitfulness, okay? And what did the Jewish people do in all of these places? At Tzo'ah Zona. Tzo'ah, modern Hebrew, at Tzo'an is a gypsy. Tzo'ah Zona, it's clearly some derogatory term, okay? Va'anochi, but God, Neta'atich Sorek. God gave the Jewish people every advantage. God, as it were, planted the Jewish people as though it were a vine. Kulo zera emet, using the finest seeds. Ve'ech nehepachtli, how could you have turned against me? You've been transformed, you've been upended into surei hagefen nochriya, into what's translated as a degenerate plant of a strange vine. This, of course, is very reminiscent of the famous parable of the vine that appears in the fifth chapter of the book of Yeshayahu, where God very clearly speaks of the Jewish people as though they were a vine whom God planted. And he says, Ashira na li didi, I will sing to my dear friend, Shirat dodila karmo, a song about a vineyard. Kerem hayali didi bekeren ben shaman. My friend, right? Everybody knows how what it means if somebody starts over saying, I have a friend, right? So the prophet Yeshayahu says, I have a friend who had a vineyard in a particular place in the land of Israel. Vayazikehu, vayesakalehu. These are different agricultural labors, actually not agricultural, these are viticultural labors, okay? I cleared the ground of weeds, I cleared the ground of stones. Vayita'ehu sorek, the same term that was used by Yirmiyahu. He planted it as a noble vine, as a noble sapling. Vayiven migdal betocho, he built a tower in the midst of the vineyard to keep an eye on it, to chase away animals that might eat the fruits. Vegam yekev chatzav bo, and then he dug a wine press in the field. Vayikav la'asot anavim. And the expectation of the owner of the planter was to grow grapes. But what came out instead? Vaya'as be'ushim. What came out instead were rotten grapes. So again, this comparison, this use of grapes, a vineyard, as a metaphor for the Jewish people, and the labor, viticultural labor, as a metaphor for God's treatment of the Jewish people, is something, again, that we find in other books of the Nevi'im as well. Now, you notice that this segment of the Haftarah goes through chapter 2, verse 28. the last verse of the Haftarah, the next verse of the Haftarah, which is also the last verse of the Haftarah, however, comes from chapter 3, verse 4. And here, I just simply had room at the bottom of the page, so I threw in the text of what I called the unused portion. Why are chapter 2, verses 29 through 37, and chapter 3, verses 1 through 3, left out of the Haftarah? Why does it jump from verse 28 in chapter 2 to verse 4 in chapter 3? And the answer is because if we look at the text here, if I were to use my color coding, look what we have here. Okay. We have Pesha. Okay. We have Hiketi, right? When God strikes the Jewish people, we have Tishkach, right? Forgetfulness or abandonment. Okay. I think you're getting the impression already. What we have here is a continuation of the terms of rebuke. And I think that whoever remember that these haftarot of the 3 weeks are actually the only ones that are actually specified in rabbinic literature. And I think that probably the rabbis had two things in mind. One was that by the time they got through verse 28 in chapter 2, they said, you know, if the point hasn't been made up to now, I think that this is just simply flogging a dead horse, to use a comparable metaphor, and that adding another 10 verses of rebuke is just maybe a bit too much. That was the first purpose. The second one was that we know that the rabbis had an inclination of signing off on a positive note. And therefore, having decided that verses 29 through 37 of chapter 2 and verses 1 through 3 of chapter 3 were just simply more of the same, they hit on verse 4 of chapter 3 as ending on a note of, on a positive note. Halo me'ata, from now on, God says of the Jewish people, karata li, you will now refer to me as avi, as my father. Aluf ne'urai ata, you are the friend of my youth. Now you remember from last week's Haftarah, we had the famous verse, right? Zacharti lach chesed ne'urayech. God says of the Jewish people, I recall in your favor the goodness of your youth, of the relationship that we enjoyed when you were young. So he's playing on that here by saying, Aluf ne'urai, the friend of my youth. But I also highlighted and underlined the word avi because it showed up in the next to the last verse of the previous segment of the Haftarah. When speaking about the Jewish people, the Navi said, starting here in verse 26, Kivoshet ganav ki yimatse, similar to the shame that's experienced by a thief when he is discovered in the act, Cain, similarly, Hovishu Beit Yisrael, has the Jewish people shamed, Hema, they, Malchehem, their kings, Sarehem, their officers, Kohanehem, their Kohanim, Nevi'ehem, their prophets, the same political, religious, spiritual leaders who were mentioned previously. And then, what does it say of all these people? Omrim, they are the ones who say, La'etz, to a piece of wood, Avi ata, You are my father. They worship it, right? They call it their father. Le'evin, to a stone, they say, At yilidetanu, you begat us. Kifanu alai oref velofanim. This too is an instance, an example of the Jewish people's turnabout, of their rebellion against God. So here, in place of their saying to a piece of wood, clearly some wooden statue of an idol, instead of calling that Avi Ata their father, they will from now on, the prophet says, at least in expectation or anticipation, refer once again to God as their father, as Avi Ata. And that is, once again, the Haftarah. Adultery means idolatry in English etymology. I will take that under advisement until I can check my Oxford English Dictionary. Don't know what this is.
Mashchit. Mashchit.
Yeah.
That was just one of the other words in the Haftorah.
Thank you. Yes,
as you were saying through it and you were looking, I think you just
Come
right
sorry,
by. So I didn't mind to send you a little message, you know, privately.
Got it. I just didn't see it in time.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, tomorrow we have a triple header. Shuli Mishkan continues her series on a tour of Israel. Tomorrow we're doing the coast. And then that will be followed right afterwards with a few minute break, but not too much. Rabbi Jonathan Ziering beginning a 5-part series on Shemitah as a lens into Torah law. Tomorrow his topic is, do the two Talmuds have to agree with each other? Do we view the two Talmuds as one? But anyways, it's well worth coming. That'll be at 12:15 tomorrow. And of course, 8:30 tomorrow night, our Parsha Shir, Rivki Freundlich from Montreal will be giving the Shir tomorrow night. And I'll be giving the Shir Pirkei Avot. Thank you for the little plug before. At 9:30 a.m. Sunday, of course, is our medical ethics conference. It's not just for doctors. I would say 75% of the people who signed up so far are not doctors. And the topics, you don't have to be a doctor. If you're a doctor and you want medical credits, CME credits you can get. But that's really a wonderful program on Sunday from 9 till 1:15 and then from 7 to 9:30 in the evening. That's a good chunk of the day. It's the 9 days, so people aren't going to any movies. Not that any movie theaters are open in Toronto anyway, but in other cities they might be open. And then we continue our regular series during the week. And on Monday, I'll probably send out tomorrow, registration, Shira Mervis will begin a 5-part series on the rabbinic rabbis from the Islamic world. Each week we'll focus on a different rabbinic figure from the Islamic world, his halachic methodology, historical significance, etc. So that's Rabbi Nishir Mervis beginning Monday at 11, right before Alex Israel's class on Jonathan Sacks. And Moshe Sokolov will give us an extra talk on Tisha B'Av. Also, that should be going out soon. That's the next Sunday. Unfortunately, whatever. So we'll have our program scheduled from 11 a.m. Eastern time. It's a little bit earlier than usual, but why not? I don't know what people are going to be exactly, Tisha B'Av, but also from our Israeli speakers, some of whom would like to speak on Tisha B'Av. It helps pass the time a little bit, perhaps. So we'll be starting at 11, going probably till 7 in the evening, 8 hours straight of learning. Like I said, anybody who comes to all 8 hours gets an Uber Eats as a reward afterwards. Okay. Any other questions, comments? I don't know. That's you can take it seriously or not. Okay. All right. Thank you very much, everybody. We hope to see you tomorrow once, twice, or three times. And have a wonderful night. Lila Tov, everybody. Be well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Do you think she's going to talk about Rabbi Eli Abadi?
No, I know what she's, no, we have, she sent me a whole bunch of topics, about 10 topics, and I chose, we chose the one. So Whatever, we'll publish all the thing tomorrow. It's gonna will the exact details.
I mean, if you want to see something really interesting, I would suggest to her. I mean, she probably knows it. To look at the Ben Ish Chai's tshuva.
Yeah, Ben Ish Chai will be one of them. The Ben Ish Chai will be one of them, of course. Yeah,
the tshuvot on bicycles on Shabbat, riding bicycles on Shabbat.
You know, Mark Shapiro once, when he was in Toronto, gave a whole talk on Moroccan halakha and Yemenite halakha. How, you know, it's halakha uninfluenced by the reform movement. Halakha uninfluenced by the reform movement is a very different halakha than we have today. Many things that became usur used to be mutter, but because the reform movement initiated them, you know, I don't have to, anybody who understands how whatever the Jewish world works. So it's very interesting. And one of the psakim was they could even go on buses on Shabbos. You know, if you pay before, some of these buses are free in some cities, you know, you get on. It's like a Shabbos elevator. What's it, the Shabbos elevator or a Shabbos bus? Yeah. One goes up and one's horizontal, one is vertical. But in our mind, in the Ashkenazic world, that would be like unheard of. That would be, you know. And well, that's a story Rabbi Rakefa told us many years ago. I told that when he went to Russia for the first time in the 80s, I don't know, maybe late 70s, 80s, I don't remember when he first went to Russia. So he asked the Rav, it must have been in the 70s, he asked the Rav if he could, the KGB, whatever, put him in a hotel not within walking distance on Shabbos. So he wanted to know if he could take a non-Jewish, you know, tax driver. Not such a difficult halachic shaila, really. And the Rav said he wants to think about it, and the Rav said he would like to allow it, but because of the conservative movement, he can't allow it. Now, it's like 20 years after the conservative movement allowed driving on Shabbos, and people won't understand that they're in a taxi, you know, people, whatever, a halachic psak takes into all these considerations. Anyways, that's just an aside. If anybody has any comments, they're free to say them.
So I'll share with you a story. How do you know whether your taxi driver in Russia is Jewish?
Right. So that's also sometimes when the Shabbos goy is, you know, is Jewish.
So I'll tell you a Maisa Shahaya.
Sure.
The building that my parents, Zichronam Livracha, lived in on Ocean Parkway in Flatbush.
Sure.
Had a lot of, you know, Orthodox Jews in it. So one of the responsibilities of the security person in the lobby was to push the elevator buttons for the Orthodox people. So on one occasion, they had to hire a new one. And you're not allowed to ask, you know, what your religion is.
Right, of course.
But, you know, being Flatbush, most of the applicants were Russians. So my father asked this applicant, whose name was Boris, said, Boris, back in Russia, you had a babushka, a grandmother? And he said, yeah, yeah. So my father said to him, what did she call you? And he smiled and said, she used to call me Baruch Bear.
Baruch Bear Boris, yes, okay, yeah. So I guess he didn't ride the elevator on Shabbos.
he didn't get the job.
He didn't get the job. It's good he doesn't know why he didn't get the job. All right. Baruch Bear's okay. A nice Jewish name. Okay. Lailu Tov, everybody. Be well. Thank you.